Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the 2-1 decision today by a 3-judge federal appeals panel of the U.S. Ninth Circuit, upholding a 2010 ruling by former U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker that overturned Proposition 8, banning same-sex marriage in California. Tobias Wolf, who teaches constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School and has participated in some of the highest-profile gay rights cases, joins us to assess the impact of the ruling and the likely appeals ahead that could go to the Supreme Court. Then we'll get an update on today's Republican primary in Minnesota with Lawrence Jacobs, the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota. With an upset victory by Rick Santorum expected, we'll examine the rollercoaster ride of Mitt Romney, who has long been projected as the winning nominee, but can't seem to maintain momentum as the restless Republican base searches for an alternative to the establishment candidate. Then finally, following the president's recent remark that knowing who is making decisions at any given time inside Iran is tough, we will try to find out who is in charge in Iran with Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Joining us now is Tobias Wolf, who teaches civil procedure and constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His advocacy has included participation in some of the highest-profile gay rights cases of the last several years. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and has written on discrimination by the Boy Scouts of America and has commented widely on marriage equality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tobias Wolf.
Ian, thank you. It's great to be on the program again.
And today, of course, there was a 2-1 decision on the California Ninth Circuit, a panel, a 3-judge panel of the U.S. Ninth Circuit, which upheld the 2010 ruling by former U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker that overturned Proposition 8 banning same-sex marriage in California. But it's a narrow decision, isn't it? It only affects the 18,000 people who were married in California. At least the ruling applies to them. It doesn't apply to the rest of the nation. And I take it that as long as this is being appealed, those people who were married and then had that taken away from them are still in limbo.
Well, let me actually just correct one part of what you just said. It is quite correct that this is a narrow constitutional ruling in several ways that we should discuss and that are important for the possible future course of this lawsuit. The case, as it was decided by the Ninth Circuit, if that ruling winds up being the last word, it applies to the entire state of California. The ruling strikes down Proposition 8 in its entirety. And the 18,000 couples who got married between the time that the California Supreme Court first recognized the right of gay couples to get married and the enactment of Prop 8, they've actually been in a stable situation. Their marriages have never been in question. The question has always been whether all the other same-sex couples in California will be able to enjoy the same right going forward. And what the Ninth Circuit panel held was that Proposition 8 singled out gay and lesbian couples, same-sex couples in California, and took a right away from them, a right that had been recognized as one of the highest order by the California Supreme Court under the state constitution and that people were enjoying very successfully. And it took that right away from gay and lesbian and same-sex couples for no legitimate reason, and that was the basis for the court's equal protection holding.
Well, indeed, there were the Judge Reinhart, who issued the majority opinion, said Proposition 8 serves no purpose and had no effect in California other than to lessen the status and human dignity of gays and lesbians in California and to officially reclassify their relationship and families as inferior to those of opposite-sex couples. The Constitution simply does not allow for laws of this sort.
That's right. And I must say, I'm very glad that the majority focused on that argument for a number of reasons. It's an argument that was put forward very strongly by the city of San Francisco in this case, by some of the amici curiae, some of the friends of the court in the case, and was also, of course, embraced by the Olson and Boys team. And the virtue of this argument is that it really focuses on the unprecedented set of circumstances that unfolded in California, where the state Supreme Court found that same-sex couples have the same rights as everybody else. People took advantage of those rights. And when Prop 8 was enacted, the California Supreme Court actually had another chance to speak to what Proposition 8 means. And in some sense, the California Supreme Court's second ruling laid the groundwork for today's decision, because the California Supreme Court is the one that made it clear in construing, interpreting what Proposition 8 does. They actually said very clearly the sole effect of Prop 8 was to separate out same-sex couples, the gay and lesbian citizens and couples of the state of California, and to make them separate and apart from everybody else. And that explanation of what Prop 8 did was really the starting point for the Ninth Circuit's analysis today. And as a consequence, you know, the Ninth Circuit is very big. It encompasses California, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Arizona, Hawaii, Oregon, Washington. It's a very big circuit. And if the Ninth Circuit had issued a very broad decision on the issue of marriage equality in the Constitution, that would have applied to all the states in the Ninth Circuit. And I think there's no question that the Supreme Court would have felt the need to take that case and weigh in on the matter. Having issued a ruling which speaks in a very surgical fashion, in a very focused fashion, to the unique set of circumstances in California, it's a ruling which only applies to California. And it is certainly possible that any further courts that are asked to take a look at this, either the en banc Ninth Circuit, the full membership of the Ninth Circuit, or the Supreme Court itself, they may simply decide to leave this ruling in place because the consequences are limited to the state of California.
So, Tobias Wolff, the losing side, who clearly have not given up on this, will they, I mean, even if the Supreme Court is not likely to take it, will they still try, or will, what is the pecking order here? Do they have to go to the full Ninth Circuit first?
I think they will certainly try to take an appeal, and the proponents of Proposition 8, who are the only parties in the case at this point who are attempting to defend that discriminatory provision, they have the option of either asking the en banc court to review the case or going straight to a request to the Supreme Court. It's also the case that the judges of the Ninth Circuit on their own can choose to initiate an en banc process and at least consider the possibility of en banc review. They don't actually need a party to ask them to do that. So the next several months will, this part of what we need to be watching is not only what the anti-gay advocates who are trying to defend Proposition 8, you know, what they choose to do, but we'll also have to watch the Ninth Circuit itself.
Well, I guess the point is, though, that at some point, when does this overturning of, or the upholding of this judge's ruling that overturned Prop 8, when does it actually go into effect? Only when the proponents of Prop 8 give up, and they will only give up if what? If the Ninth Circuit says it's all over, or if the Supreme Court says we won't take it?
Yeah, no, you're quite right in saying that the decision won't go into effect, which means that Prop 8 won't go away until basically the appeals have come to a close. The Ninth Circuit itself, the panel itself, included a footnote that said that their stay remains in effect until what's called the mandate of the opinion issues, and it seems clear the most likely course of events is that the opinion won't actually go into effect until all the appeals have been exhausted. And, you know, how long that is going to take will depend, of course, both upon whether the Ninth Circuit itself decides that it's interested in hearing the case, and if not, whether the Supreme Court decides that it's interested. It's not going to be immediate, certainly. I think that the fastest that we could see the opinion go into effect is certainly several months from now. You know, we have to have both the Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court decide that they're not interested. That would be the fastest way for the opinion to go into effect. And of course, if either the Ninth Circuit en banc or the Supreme Court decides that they do want to hear a further appeal, then there could be a quite lengthy process of at least another year or two or thereabouts.
But for those same-sex couples in the state of California who want to get married, they should, I suppose, be happy that the ruling is narrow enough that it may discourage the Supreme Court from taking it up. There's much less certainty with the Supreme Court than there is with the Ninth Circuit in the state of California.
Well, I wouldn't presume to say that there's certainty in any of these courts, but I think that you're quite right in saying that not just same-sex couples in California, of course, but everybody who values fairness and equality in California should be very happy that this was a narrowly focused ruling. I think that's a very good thing indeed. And I must tell you, you know, I lived in California for some time. I have family in California. It remains a very important part of my life. And it kills me that same-sex couples continue to be living under this separate and unequal status in the state of California. And I want this decision, if it is indeed the final word, to go into effect as soon as possible.
And there's six states, including the District of Columbia, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa, Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York, that California should be joining, and presumably at some point will. I suppose, again, Tobias Wolf teaches civil procedure and constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and his advocacy work includes participation in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. It does seem, given the way that the 2-1 vote went down, a Jimmy Carter appointee and a Bill Clinton appointee were in favor of upholding the overturning of Prop 8, whereas an appointee by President George W. Bush dissented. I suppose that says that elections have consequences. And also, I suppose in the context of the current election we're having, given that Mitt Romney is a likely candidate on the Republican side, and the Mormon Church had a huge and leading role in Prop 8, do you expect this to be an issue in this current election?
Well, I'll say a couple of things to that. You're quite correct that elections have consequences, and I think that one of the many reasons that this year's presidential election should be of great importance to anyone who cares about fairness and equality is because of the prospect of further appointments to the Supreme Court. I think it is less true than it has been in the past that ideology or political affiliation is a great predictor of how judges and even sometimes legislators will approach marriage equality. I mean, it is certainly the case that the Democratic Party has been a much greater friend to gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender people at the national level and at the state level than has the Republican Party. But we have seen increasingly both judges and individual legislators in states like New York and like in Iowa, for example, really defying expectations when it comes to their political affiliation. So my hope, and this is of course the way it should be, is that basic issues of equality will not map onto political party as consistently going forward as they have in the past. You know, and as far as the individual members of this panel are concerned, these are all very smart judges. And, you know, the opinions are very thoughtful opinions. Judge Smith's dissenting opinion is, I think, wrong in a number of very important analytical ways, but it's not a political opinion. You know, Judge Smith was doing his job as a judge. I think he just got it wrong this time.
Well, it is, though, pretty clear on the record that the Mormon Church played an active role in this. And
Right. I didn't mean to ignore that part of your question. No, let me actually say very directly about that. Mitt Romney issued a statement from his campaign today decrying the Ninth Circuit's opinion and saying the fight will continue around these issues. And in contrast, the White House press corps asked Jay Carney, at the White House press secretary, about the ruling today, and he reiterated the president's long-held position, which is strong opposition to Proposition 8 and measures like Proposition 8 that have as their only purpose to divide and discriminate, which is, in fact, exactly what the Ninth Circuit said about Proposition 8 in striking it down today, is that its only purpose was to divide and to discriminate.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Tobias Wolff.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Tobias Wolff, who teaches civil procedure and constitution law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. His advocacy work has included participation in some of the highest profile gay rights cases of the last several years. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll get an update on today's Republican primary in Minnesota.
Ooh, love breaks the machine. Everything's half a dream. How can it be? Everything's born in shame. It's not just me. Particle wave duality.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War Question, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you again.
And today in Minnesota and Colorado, there are caucuses, and of course there's a non-binding primary in Missouri, which doesn't have Gingrich on the ballot. But in your state, Minnesota, at this point, obviously the polls are just closing, that the Democratic-affiliated public policy polling, the PPP, suggests Rick Santorum may have a strong showing in both Minnesota and Colorado. What's your sense there on the ground, Lawrence Jacobs?
It looks as if Santorum has really picked up support in the conservative base of the Republican Party. Over the last few decades, there has been an internal civil war within the Minnesota Republican Party, as in other states. And the evangelical, the Tea Party, conservative populists, and the libertarians have put an enormous amount of pressure on the establishment and the kind of Republicans that focused on winning general elections. Santorum is tapping into that insurgent ascendance.
So is that to say that if Michelle Bachmann were still in the race, the home girl, if you will, or the hometown girl, would she be picking up that same vote? Is that the vote that she also identified?
Exactly. Michelle Bachmann very much reflected this conservative insurgency in the Minnesota Republican Party. It helps to explain her rise and her ability to remain the leading voice of conservatives in Minnesota. Probably Bachmann reflects better the Minnesota Republican Party than Tim Pawlenty.
And Tim Pawlenty, of course, is a pretty active surrogate for Mitt Romney, is he not?
He is. Tim Pawlenty, very effective as a governor and winning statewide election, did have trouble with the Republican Party activists who were fairly conservative, felt that Pawlenty was not stiff enough in rejecting increased spending and revenue hikes. It's probably worth noting as a footnote that Tim Pawlenty set the record for the number of vetoes. So he was conservative enough, just not enough for the conservative insurgents who now probably have the upper hand in the Minnesota Republican Party and will be playing a major role in the and have been playing a major role in the Minnesota caucuses today.
And Lawrence Jacobs, just to go back a little bit, when Pawlenty was running for the nomination, he was considered something of a favorite. In the first debate, he kind of piked out on taking on Romney and was criticized for sort of wimping out. Conspiratorial minds might wondering what's happening now. He gave Romney a pass, and now he's become Romney's surrogate. So is he angling for a cabinet post?
You know, that's always speculation. It's hard to say. You know, I think probably at heart, Tim Pawlenty agreed with Romney on some issues. They clearly had some differences, which explains why Pawlenty, you know, went ahead and made a pretty vigorous campaign, even though he departed early.
I see. So, again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who's the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. So, what's going on with the Republican Party in general in terms of these primaries? It's just been such a seesaw from the beginning, and so many, almost every one of the candidates has had their moment in the sun and then flamed out. But the sort of seesawing continues.
It sure does, and I think it reflects the fact that the Republican Party is very much up for grabs. There is a longstanding establishment associated with the business sector that focused also on how do you win elections. Romney is their candidate, but there has been a very real and very significant upsurge of these philosophical conservatives. It's the evangelicals, the Tea Partiers, conservative populists, the libertarians. And for them, winning elections is important, but standing for principle is more important. And every time it looks as if Romney's got momentum, we see, as we did in South Carolina, and I think as we're going to see today in Colorado and Minnesota, that the conservative populists have risen up and reminded Pawlenty that the Republican Party is no longer the party of his father, or even the party that Romney hopes to lead.
And Pawlenty has actually come out pretty strong against Santorum, hasn't he, clearly on Romney's behalf?
Well, Tim Pawlenty certainly has a strong base of support and an organizational might in Minnesota that he is loaning to Mitt Romney, and as part of that, he's taken on Santorum. But what I would tell you about that is the ferocity of the attack that's now started on Santorum reflects the level of concern within the Romney camp. For a while, Romney was ignoring his opponents in the Republican Party and aiming strictly on Barack Obama. Now he realizes that his candidacy is really under threat. If Santorum or Gingrich were to drop out, Romney would have a very serious problem on his hand because the conservatives are going to mobilize around one candidate, whether it's Santorum or Gingrich, and Romney may well find himself in the losing end of a number of the state primaries and caucuses.
Well, that's pretty much Gingrich's strategy, isn't it? I mean, he's a one-man show. He has no organization. He has less money than Santorum, but he's going to stay in there as long as he can afford the airfare, right? Until
it's true, but the question, I think, is very much out there, whether Gingrich is really going to have what it takes to remain a factor. And as I've watched him campaigning in Minnesota, he looks surprisingly flat, and it may reflect some real inner turmoil that he's facing. And, you know, if Santorum has a very good night tonight, it could be part of the kind of downfall of Newt Gingrich's campaign.
Well, I thought Newt Gingrich was counting on Super Tuesday in Georgia.
He's talking about that, and of course, Georgia is his home state. So like New Hampshire for Romney, I don't think a whole lot of folks are going to put a whole lot of stock in Georgia. We could be moving through Super Tuesday with Newt Gingrich not having carried a state other than his home state.
And South Carolina,
of course.
Yeah. So, Lawrence Jacobs, given that both these states today, at least two out of the three, Colorado and Minnesota, your state, are trending, shall we say, to Santorum because of the religious right, you know, influence in the state party, what about the subtext there in so much of what's going on in the religious right in terms of their leeriness or wariness of Romney? Much has said that he's, you know, as Gingrich has tried to frame him as a Massachusetts moderate, but there's also a religious subtext, surely, about Mormonism.
Absolutely. This has been something that's been kept off center stage. But for many evangelicals, there is a fairly serious theological difference over kind of the major questions of the Eucharist and other issues. And for them, Romney is really not acceptable. I think the roosters are coming home here in that the Republican Party is so far to the right of mainstream America, and we're seeing Romney's kind of heroic effort to stake out a middle ground to run a strong general election campaign against Barack Obama being whittled away. Romney himself has seen his negative ratings soar as Gingrich has ripped him apart. And now we're going to see, I think, Romney having to move even more conservative to take on Santorum if he does as well as it appears at the moment today.
And why do these conservative Protestant voters, what is it about Santorum they find acceptable, given that he's, you know, a Catholic fundamentalist, if you will, or at least a very conservative Catholic? Is this just the lesser of the two evils, Catholicism versus Mormonism?
Yeah, I think there's much more tolerance within the evangelical world for different views of Christianity. Mormonism is really outside the orbit. And so I don't know if lesser two evils, it's just there's more affinity. And clearly Catholicism is recognized as within the family of Christianity, whereas Mormonism is not. But again, the key fact here is that the overriding story about Romney's inevitability and the growing momentum coming out of Florida and Nevada has been dealt, it appears, a strong blow today in Colorado and Minnesota, perhaps. And so this is now going to raise more questions about the Romney campaign and whether he can truly lock this up, or if we're looking at a pretty tough battle that could stretch into March and, you know, perhaps later than that.
Well, it's not just Romney, though, surely, Lawrence Jacobs. Isn't he? He has the Republican establishment behind him, right? The more pragmatic wing of the party, if you will, the ones that are looking towards the general election, not the ideologically pure Tea Party crowd who are, you know, running on their passions.
Yes, that's absolutely right. That Romney is representing a wing of the Republican Party, the establishment wing. He represents also the more pragmatic business base of the Republican Party that's looking for lower regulations and taxes and spending that's kind of pulled back from Social Security and Medicare and health reform. And to that extent, Romney really stands for a particular style of mainstream establishment Republican Partyism that is under assault within the Republican Party by this insurgent conservative force. They appear to be the winners today.
Well, they've been written off, though, before today. So I guess what you're telling us, Lawrence Jacobs, is that the announcement of their death is premature, that the Tea Party is still alive.
It's absolutely still alive. And I think the key issue as we move through today, but then into the other states in the coming weeks, will be the composition of the states. The more moderate states in terms of the Republican Party will be more friendly to Romney, but the more conservative states in the Southwest and in the South and parts of the North, as we're seeing in Minnesota, are going to present a great challenge for Mitt Romney. He does not have the nomination locked up despite the media drumbeat to the contrary.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence Jacobs, does this then say that Barack Obama is one of the luckiest politicians on the face of the earth? He ran against Alan Keyes, an eccentric candidate for Senate, and whipped him. He ran against McCain, who was, you know, a less than exciting candidate who the economy crashed on his head towards the end. And you think he's going to get pretty much a free pass here this time around because of this fratricide on the Republican side?
Well, it's not going to be a free pass. This is going to be a very intense election. And I think there'll be real quite a probability that Obama could lose re-election. But there's no doubt this is one of the most friendly scenarios for the White House. You remember back in the fall, they were actually weighing in trying to damage Romney, assuming he was going to be the candidate and wanting to ding him up. And then I think they've more or less sat back, realizing that Gingrich was doing their work for them much more effectively than they could have. Again, the negative perceptions that Americans have of Romney has really risen rapidly as Gingrich's campaign took off. But now we're looking at what I think will be a much more drawn-out battle for the Republican nomination that was anticipated even a week ago. And that is going to drain Republican money. It's going to ding up whoever emerges as the candidate. And if it's Romney, he's going to be even weaker. So this is, for the Obama campaign, it's good news. They're going to face a candidate who is diminished and will have a hard time moving back to the center when it comes time to general election. It'll be easier for Barack Obama to frame a choice between himself and a Republican Party that is too far to the right.
Well, just to pick up on something as we close, Lawrence Jacobs, you were saying that it would be close, but Obama's lucky because of what's happening on the Republican side. What's your analysis of why it will be close?
Well, the fact that you have so many Americans who are struggling to keep their homes, who have lost their jobs or are underemployed is just the cloud that is haunting President Obama. He obviously has had some better economic news recently. If that continues, it clearly is going to help him. But it's certainly quite possible that we're going to see some unfavorable job numbers in the coming months or more stagnation in the housing markets. There are many Americans who have a quite sour view of the president's handling of the economy. And for folks, that is the number one issue heading into the election. So if this were a straight-up referendum on Barack Obama's handling of the economy, he could well face defeat. Now, if the economy improves and continues to improve as it has been, I think he'll have a much better shot at withstanding that. But if we see some bad job numbers coming in the next couple months, that's going to hurt him a lot. So having a Republican candidate who's going to be less than attractive is going to provide yet another opportunity for the president to frame this election not as a referendum, are you better now than 4 years ago, but as a choice between the known, if less than adored, Obama presidency and the unknown and perhaps frightful Republican alternative. That's what the White House wants to set up in this long, drawn-out, and quite brutal battle for the Republican nomination is playing into Obama's hands.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War Question, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about who's in charge in Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and the new book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the president, in a recent interview with NBC, was talking about how difficult it is to deal with Iran, that he basically says, knowing who is making decisions at any given time inside Iran is tough. And now we're hearing today that the Iranian parliament have summoned President Ahmadinejad. That's the first time that's happened since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. And there's some doubt as to whether he will show up. There's apparently quite a power struggle going on within the conservative camps. Do you have any inside knowledge, Trita, of what the president's referring to?
Well, I think President Obama is quite correct. We know very little about how decisions in Iran are being made. We have an understanding that the circle of people around Khamenei who are critical to the important decision-making have become a smaller circle. It's also become a more hard-line circle. But beyond that, we know very little. And it's not necessarily very surprising. The combination of the fact that the Iranian system is not a transparent democratic system and the fact that we don't have any diplomatic relations means that it's going to be very difficult to know how decisions are being made over there. Part of the purpose of diplomacy is actually to shed more light and transparency on what the thinking of the other side is, how they're making their decisions, how they view their interests, and how they view themselves in the region. We oftentimes forget that, but that is actually one of the critical benefits, takeaways of having some sort of a diplomatic relationship or having negotiations with the country.
So in terms of, though, of paralysis or division at the top, my understanding is that President Ahmadinejad and his supporters want to reduce the influence of the ruling clerics and the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. And on the other hand, apparently the parliament is dominated by Khamenei's supporters, including the speaker, and they're apparently summoning Ahmadinejad to answer questions about the sacking of the intelligence minister and the foreign minister. When the Ayatollah Khamenei decided to overrule the president and ordered the reinstatement of the intelligence minister, supposedly that enraged Ahmadinejad to the point where he stayed away from government meetings for 11 days. So give me a sense of this kind of brinkmanship, because the elections are coming up in March, aren't they, next month?
Yes, and I think the elections coming up in March is a critical point here. You have a situation in which the next parliament, the configuration of the next parliament, may actually end up completely finishing Ahmadinejad and his camp as a political force in Iran. And prior to that, the existing parliament, led by Larijani, who is one of Ahmadinejad's key rivals, is obviously going to increase pressure and do everything he can to undermine Ahmadinejad in order to guarantee or increase the chances of the Ahmadinejad faction losing out big time in the next parliamentary elections in a couple of weeks.
So that presupposes then, well, in a normal political environment, Trita Parsi, that would suggest that the right wing has come back. But I take it that what's going on here is that the center and the left are not participating. Is that what's happening?
Well, this is not a fight between the left and the right wing or even the center and the right wing. This is a fight between various parts of the same right wing. It's somewhat similar to, as every once in a while you do have some fights within neoconservative circles here in Washington, D.C. The political spectrum in Iran has shrunk considerably over the last 10 years, but particularly after the 2009 election scandal. So as a result, the fights that we're seeing are increasingly amongst the hardliners themselves, because there's very few non-hardliners left within Iran's political elite that actually have any particular political relevance right now.
So in terms of the broader politics of Iran, the rest of it simply shut out. And is that a factor of how the clerics have always chosen who gets to a run in the first place? In other words, have they narrowed it down to the fact to the point where only extreme conservatives can even run in for parliament?
That was how they did it in the past, but this time around it's even further so, because now certain parties are not permitted to run, and already by having essentially politically assassinated a lot of political figures that are not falling into the right-wing camp, you actually have pacified that element of the political spectrum. Those people are not even running. In fact, many of the reformists, some of the key reformists, circles have called for a boycott of the elections because they don't see any point in participating in this any longer.
So, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. And his new book is A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. And in terms of diplomacy, there seems to be, there at least there were indications that there were meetings that took place recently in Turkey that Larijani showed up at. And there was a sense at the time, that was quite recently, that perhaps both the Iranian leadership and the leadership in the White House had realized they were staring into the abyss and they wanted to pull back a little bit. But things have been ratcheted up since then, with the president announcing more sanctions on Iran's central bank. Where is this game? I'm trying to get a sense of this triangular game that's going on between Iran, Israel, and the United States. And is it a situation where the Israelis have forced the United States into toughening the sanctions because they threaten a war, which would be a catastrophe? Or on the other hand, are the U.S. using the threat of Israel doing something catastrophic to have leverage against the Iranians? How's this game being played, to your mind?
I think you described it quite well, and I would add to it that the United States, the Obama administration itself, has also used the threat of an Israeli military attack in order to strong-arm other countries to agree to sanctions that they, under normal circumstances, would not agree to. But I think while that tactic worked to a certain extent, even with Russia and China, that is now past us. There's not any longer a clear consensus within the P5+1 on how to deal with Iran. And I think the disagreements, the very stark and angry disagreements within the P5 on how to deal with Syria, has also taken a poll on the ability to muster a consensus on Iran. We are going to see in 2012 a year of conflict management. The Obama administration's ability to muster or even pursue a diplomatic breakthrough is very limited. Any expectation on diplomacy has to be quite moderate. But if they can continue to ensure that there isn't any war in 2012, then perhaps after the U.S. elections, after the Iranian presidential elections in 2013, there will be some greater flexibility for a diplomatic effort. But that, even under those circumstances, will require tremendous amount of political courage. And to be frank, we are not seeing particularly much political courage in Tehran or in Washington right now.
Well, back to what you were saying earlier, though, Trita Parsi, that in effect, what's happening now in terms of this internal wrangling amongst the ruling conservative elite in Iran is quite soon, we'll be ringing the Ahmadinejad's death knell, that the supreme leader is essentially going to make him politically irrelevant. So that would assume then that at least what the president's saying, what he said on Sunday, that he doesn't know who to talk to over there, that would get clearer. But I spoke recently with an Iranian human rights activist who made the case that the supreme leader and the clerical establishment have so little legitimacy, and that that in many ways they want chaos, or if not war.
I think certainly there is a certain degree of a desire for a managed chaos, particularly when they are suffering from such domestic legitimacy deficits as they currently are. This regime does have a legitimacy crisis right now. However, I'm a little bit skeptical about the argument that they want war. If they want war, it's not particularly difficult to get a war right now. You can get a war extremely easily. So I'm not so convinced by that. I think there is much more of a situation in which the elite is politically paralyzed, cannot make decisions on such important issues such as the U.S. and Iran, and a phenomenon that exists both on the Iranian and on the American side, which is that after having essentially pursued enmity or some level of animosity for 30 years, that is what the two sides are most comfortable with. That's what they know how to do. That's their comfort zone. To muster the political will to take the risk of trying something different is a little bit too much for them, particularly under the circumstances in which the elite is at war with itself, more or less.
But you mentioned a little while ago acrimony amongst the permanent five, Dr. Tridipasi, over Syria, where the U.S. UN representative called the Russians' behavior disgusting and wasn't much less disgusted with the Chinese as well. So just in terms of, it does seem, and the president has said this and so has the Secretary of State, that Assad is on the wrong side of history and he'll eventually go. Assuming that is the case, Iran clearly does not want to lose this relationship and see Assad go down. So going back to that earlier question about how much they want war, if there was a war against Iran, that would immediately end the support for the anti-Assad Syrian regime, because they could not be seen as siding with Israel. So again, I don't want to be conspiratorial, but would certainly be the consequence of a war, right?
It could potentially be, but it's an odd argument, because it would mean that you would risk something that is tremendously valuable to you in order not to lose something that is of secondary value to you. So it still doesn't add up, in my assessment. I think from the perspective of the Iranian government, they're probably very concerned about losing Assad. But what they're mostly concerned about is that there would be some sort of a smooth regime change in Syria that would turn Syria into a pro-Saudi, pro-Western country. That's probably their nightmare scenario. The most likely scenario, as things are developing right now, is that Assad would continue his brutal repression of the, particularly the Sunni population. It would end up in some form of a civil war. It would be complete chaos in Syria, somewhat similar to Iraq a couple of years ago. And within that, the Iranians would maintain a certain level of influence over at least certain parts of Syria. But there would also be an influx of Saudi, Turkish, American influence in Syria as well. But Syria would suffer tremendously under most of these different scenarios. I mean, one really must have a lot of sympathy for the Syrian people right now, because they are stuck not only in a civil war, not only in under the repression of the Assad government, but also in a geopolitical context in which they have very little say in and then very little influence over.
So, Dr. Tridipasi, again, co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and his new book, just out, is A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. I spoke yesterday with Flint Leverett, who was on the National Security Council under President Bush. He quit, I believe, over the intransigence of the Bush administration, which was essentially being run by Dick Cheney, that at the time of the Iraq War in 2003, the Iranians made an offer to the United States to basically put everything on the table, including the nuclear portfolio. And they were quite concerned that after Saddam had been toppled, maybe they were going to be next. And this was a real opportunity to open a dialogue. And clearly, given what's happened since, it in retrospect, it looks like one of the greatest acts of folly. But apparently, it was torpedoed by the neocons and by Dick Cheney, who apparently just ran rings around Bush. He didn't basically know what was happening in terms of foreign policy. And Leverett quit over this, and he basically is appalled at what's happening, and like a lot of people, thinks that we're on a collision course towards war. You keep holding out the possibility of diplomacy, and your book is about Obama's single roll of the dice where he made some efforts but didn't follow through. Do you think that what's happening now is going to get people's attention? Because clearly in an election year, any kind of war, whether it's a small war or a large war in that region, is going to affect the price of gasoline and President Obama's election chances.
Well, I do agree that we are in a situation in which more people may realize the tremendous folly and danger of not pursuing serious, sustainable negotiations. Because if we continue to gravitate towards a confrontation with Iran, which we currently are, then and then the risk of that continues to grow towards the point in which it at some point potentially could become inevitable, then, you know, it's going to be a very dangerous situation and a very sad situation, because we will then have gone into war without having first exhausted diplomacy. And that is quite unfortunate, to say the least.
So did you, the New York Times on Tuesday had a front page story about trying to gauge the mood inside Iran, and what was striking about it was on the one hand, the average Iranian and the middle class and working class people are really suffering as the currency is devalued. Apparently members of the elite were able to change their dollars at very favorable exchange rates before the real collapsed. But what was clear, at least to me from that article, was how distant the nuclear portfolio is from the average Iranian, that they simply don't understand why it is such a big deal. And what's your sense of that?
I do agree in the assessment that, you know, the average Iranian doesn't wake up in the morning and thinks about the nuclear program. What is odd, though, is that some commentators have then interpreted that to mean that they actually don't support it. And those are two very, very different things. It's one thing to say that, look, this is not their top priority. It's a different thing to say that actually as a result they don't support it. I think there is support for the program. In fact, most analysts with access to Iran do agree that there is support for it. But I think the Iranian population is quite perplexed that the West has now pursued a policy that really is putting a tremendous amount of pressure on the Iranian population, even though the West does know that the Iranian population at large really does not agree with the government and really does not have the ability to change the government's policies. Why is the Iranian people being punished in the middle here?
Well, just in closing, Dr. Tridipati, there's another wild card in this, of course, and that is Netanyahu, the Israeli leader, who it's no secret he has disdain for President Obama. It's no secret that he's close to Eric Cantor and the Republicans, and it does seem in this current election where the so-called front runner Romney is getting beaten up and looking weaker and weaker. It would seem that that the best chance the Republicans will have for winning back the White House is if Obama is stuck with a war in the Middle East that he doesn't approve of, and he's on the sidelines while the Republicans are screaming to support our closest ally Israel, and already they're running on a ticket of who they're stepping over each other to be the first to bomb Iran. So that's, you know, I know it's almost treasonous to suggest treason in the U.S. government, in the context of the U.S. government and electoral politics. But it did happen with the under Kissinger, or before Kissinger came in, over the peace talks with the Vietnamese, where Madam Chiang Kai-shek, at Kissinger's behest, got the South Vietnamese delegation to walk out, and that affected Humphrey's re-election chances and helped Nixon. And Gary Sick, who was the National Security Council guy on Iran throughout the hostage crisis, believes that there was some kind of deal made between the elements in Iran and the Reagan administration, who won largely because Jimmy Carter was twisting in the wind. I know it's a long-winded question, but is it possible that Barack Obama could find himself in Jimmy Carter's shoes?
I think the president knows quite well that if there is a military conflict with Iran, there may be a bit of a rally around the flag type of effect to begin with. But the most important effect is that the cost of oil will skyrocket, which will then have an immediate impact on gas prices in the U.S., which means that it will reach $4, $5, $6, $7 a gallon. When gas prices go up, job creation goes down, which then means that his success on the economy will be absent. And that is the most important decisive factor for his reelection. If the economy is bad, if he has an unemployment rate above 8%, then he's not going to get reelected. So it does seem as if any type of a military confrontation would most likely be to the detriment of Obama's election bid.
Well, the Secretary of Defense, only a few days ago, speaking to the Washington Post, said that he's concerned that the Israelis will attack Iran in the spring.
And I think many people in the White House and Obama administration share that view. In my own conversation with some of them, they expressed deep concerns about the likelihood that the Israelis may do something that would be quite detrimental to the United States. The question is why it's so difficult for the Obama administration to really put down its foot and say, don't do something that will hurt America's interests as well as put American soldiers in harm's way.
Well, we will have to wait and see. It's extraordinary in a way that we even having this conversation to think that the superpower is so helpless, but apparently that is the case. I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Tridipasi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. His new book is A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.